So we are talking about the phases of the quantumizing model. Of course, we are writing this model in this way, as usual. So we have the sum over all the sides of this Hamiltonian. I'm writing it in one special dimension. Although most of the things that I'm going to say now are valid in any dimension. So we have seen several things. We have seen that in the limit for lambda going to infinity, we have, it's raining. We have the so-called disordered or paramagnetic phase. In which there is no finite value for the order parameter. So this is zero. And correlation functions are also small. And before I write that, let me finish. And this disorder phase is also non-symmetry breaking. So we have understood that in order to have a non-vanishing value of the order parameter, we need to break the symmetry. And in the tutorial, you have learned that all these results hold not just in this limit, but for a finite range of lambda, what we call a lambda, large lambda, in which case the correlation functions, instead of being identically zero, they decay exponentially in this parameter psi. You have seen this because, at the very least, you have computed the gap, right? And you have seen that there is a finite gap, and psi is proportional, is equal, actually, in this case, to delta to the minus 1. So because there is a finite gap, then there is a finite correlation length. These correlation functions can be computed exactly by solving the model or numerically when you cannot solve the model. And we will see more about that. So the point is that all these results are valid for a large lambda. And in fact, you have computed this gap, right? And this gap is what? Remember? In perturbation theory, using perturbation theory, what you did in the tutorial. It's something like this, right? It's 1 minus lambda. So you know that when you do perturbation theory, of course, depending on the degree of sophistication that you want to reach, but definitely, you know that physicists usually like to trust perturbation theory, but we always know that we cannot trust perturbation theory when the gap goes to zero, right? Because when you do perturbation theory, in the expansion, you have the gap at the denominator. So even if you want to trust this result for lambda, not only infinity, but all the way to some value, well, definitely you cannot trust it for lambda equal 1, right? Because then the gap goes to 0 and perturbation theory collapses. So by large lambda, I really mean lambda greater than one. A similar perturbation theory in terms of small lambda will tell us that all the results that hold in the ferromagnetic symmetry breaking limit, they also hold for every value of lambda from 0 to 1 excluded. And I believe this is one of your homeworks, right? To do the perturbation theory for small lambda. And so it would seem that indeed we do not have just two special points, but we have a full range of values of lambda, such that if this is lambda equal 1, lambda smaller than 1 is the symmetry breaking phase with a spontaneous value of sigma z that is different from 0. And here we have the paramagnet. Also in perturbation theory, one can find for sigma z as a function of lambda something that does like this. And then here we cannot really trust what's going on, right? Because at lambda equal 1, we cannot trust perturbation theory anymore. So all this suggests that indeed at lambda equal 1, although perturbation theory collapses, but collapses because the gap is 0, and therefore lambda equal 1 is our quantum critical point, the place where the gap goes to 0. So we have seen that this is a result from perturbation theory. However, there are at least two more ways of arguing about this, and they are both very important ways that are used in many other cases in theoretical physics, so we will see them. But before doing that, I want to comment a little bit more about the fate of correlation functions in these two phases. Okay, so one thing here is very clear. When we have a unique ground state, and there is a finite gap above this ground state, so finite gap, and we find that our correlation functions, both connected and non-connected, decay exponentially. The connected and not connected are the same, because remember, to get the correlation function, you also need to write the product of these guys, but they are zero. So in the disordered phase, it doesn't really matter whether I talk about connected or non-connected correlation functions. So I have exponentially decaying correlations. And we would like to understand whether this is really a direct consequence of this. We want to sketch a general theory of how disorder, order, and phases have something to do with correlations. So we have a unique ground state, finite delta, and no order. What is the situation in the symmetry breaking phase? Okay, now we have to be much more careful because things are more complicated. So first of all, we have a degenerate ground state. The presence of the degenerate ground state means that although there is a gap above this degenerate ground state, these two states are gapless. Right? There is no gap between them. You have your positive one and your negative one. In the limit of g going to zero, this is all spins up and this is all spin down. But for finite g, for finite lambda, these two states are not exactly all spins up or all spins down. But these have a positive magnetization, these have a negative magnetization. But there is no gap between these two. In the limit of all spins up plus all spins down, okay, so this is our symmetric state in which we have superimposed these two ground states. Notice that connected correlation functions are non-zero. Connected This is, you just need to compute this object minus this object times the same for sigma j in this state, and you will see that they are non-zero. It's a simple exercise. Not only this is true in this limit, but also in all the small lambda phase. So it seems that degeneracy, which definitely is connected to order and to symmetry breaking, results in fast non-exponential decay of correlations. So why these things are connected? Symmetry breaking means that the ground state does not obey the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So the symmetry operator sends one ground state in another ground state. So they're different. So if they are different, these two ground states, there is a degeneracy, means there are two states. And moreover, they are distinguished by something local. For instance, this state has positive magnetization, this other state has negative magnetization. Therefore, there is order. So this situation seems to imply that when we superimpose these states, we get non-exponentially decaying correlations. Okay. So this is a very important and powerful framework. It seems that we can capture the nature of order in the way correlations behave at long distance. Seems that being order a consequence of symmetry breaking, then we can obtain long-range correlations by superimposing the two symmetry broken states. Whereas it seems that when you have this situation, order, finite gap, unique ground state, then they need to decay exponentially. So we would like to understand how many of these things are really like that always, and anticipate a very beautiful result that we will discuss at the end of this week, And it's a theorem that says when you have a unique ground state with a gap, correlations cluster, meaning they decay fast. So this is a theorem. It's true in every dimension. It's a beautiful theorem that we will prove in a few days. But what about this other implication? Yes?
Sir, can you go over again on why you should expect non-exponential decay given symmetry?
Oh, okay. So you see that this state in which we can write the state when there is a symmetry breaking, this is the symmetric state, but the existence of this state comes from symmetry breaking. This one has non-vanishing connected correlation functions. In fact, they have value 1. They do not decay at all in this state. When lambda is different from 0, they decay, but they do not decay exponentially. One can, you can try to compute this, that it's also true not only here, but in the whole phase. You can use perturbation theory to do that. But there are also other ways. So, okay, if we have a gap above a single state, we know that there is no order, at least the way we understand order in terms of symmetry breaking, and then all correlations decay exponentially. But is this also true? So if we look at a material and we see that all correlations vanish very fast, doesn't mean that there is no order. In other words, is symmetry breaking the only way to have order? It turns out that the answer is negative. So for a long time, it was thought that all the matter, all the ways in which quantum mechanical systems can organize themselves in having order is based on symmetry. Once you classify all the possible way of breaking the symmetries of a Hamiltonian, you have classified all types of order. However, this is not the case. And the way people have started to think that this is not the case is exactly because they couldn't see why this should hold. After a while, so when you cannot prove something, maybe either it's a very difficult theorem or you start thinking, oh, maybe it's not true. Maybe the fact that there are exponential decaying correlations doesn't mean that there is no order. Quantum mechanical states that have this exotic type of order in which correlation functions still decay exponentially are called topological states, and we will see them in the third week of this course. And when they were found, it was very exciting because it's a new world, a new way for quantum many-body systems to display non-trivial properties. Okay. Second comment. In the tutorial, we have discussed why states like this are stable. And states like this are not. Right? And what we said was that in order to change from this state to this state, we need a non-local operator. Thank you. And non-local operators, remember, we forbade them. We say, in the infinite system, they do not exist. And then, even though we didn't make a rigorous argument, in the finite system, if all the interactions are local, they should conspire together to make a very large operator, and this could be very unlikely. So we were left with this vague notion of being unlikely, but at least we have an intuition of why this process could be difficult to realize. Whereas we saw in the tutorial that if I act with sigma z on one spin, this goes into the one with minus in its orthogonal state. So it's not stable. So definitely, this is not a process that is easy to forbid, right? It's just touching one spin. So that's why this is not stable. So we saw that. And I want to make a couple of remarks about this. So first of all, notice two things. OK, remark one. Is it really necessary that such a local operator should exist? Such that sends this state into this state. So did we get unlucky? Maybe it is in this system that there is such a thing. But more generally, if I have an other system that has symmetry breaking, so that I have two states and I want to make a superposition, could it happen that in this other state there is no such local operator that does, you know, that spoils this superposition, that changes this this phase? And the answer is no. Why? Because if you notice, this is not any operator. This is the order parameter. The fact that there are two different states is the same thing of saying that there is an operator such that some operator O such that in this state, as a value, let me say plus one in this case, which is different from what you have in this state, it's the order parameter. We can really say that, in fact, there are two different states because there is a local order parameter that tells them apart. But it's a necessity, and it's an exercise in linear algebra, to see that if in this space, this operator has matrix elements, plus one and minus one on the diagonal, then in this basis, it would have matrix elements like this. In other words, this is like this is the sigma z operator. In the plus and minus basis must become the x operator, the one that changes one into the other. So it's not by chance. If you have a local order parameter, so if you have symmetry breaking, then these superpositions must be fragile. So remark one, symmetry breaking implies no Schrödinger cats. And now you can appreciate why people are so excited in discovering that maybe symmetry breaking is not the only mechanism to have order. Because if it's the only mechanism to have order, it means in nature we cannot have Schrödinger. But if there are other forms of order beyond symmetry breaking, then we don't know. Right? There is a door open to having something that is like a Schrödinger cat. And why would we like to have something that is like a Schrödinger cat? And this is a remark too. Well, not only it's very cool, no? But so look at this process. So let's go back to the one that instead is robust. We are saying if my state is zero, this will not happen, so this state will not become one. What does this process resemble? What does it remind you of? What is it? In a very different context. This is a way of saying that I've written some information. I can call this my logical bit zero. And if interactions could flip it to one, I would lose my information, right? But you see that there is a physical, or there could be, a physical way to forbid that to happen. Because this T is either forbidden mathematically or unlikely in some sense that we have not precised yet. We just have an intuition. So you see, it means I can write information and know that it will stay there. And this is exactly how your all your memory devices, your hard drive, your flash drive, they all work in this way. Why they don't lose information? If I would only encode my information, some spin being up, all the interactions with the environment, stray magnetic fields, anything, would flip them down. You lose the information. But it's encoded in something larger, such that to flip it, you have to flip everything. And this is unlikely. Unless we will see that this is unlikely below some temperature, which is the critical temperature for a classical system. But that's fine, because this critical temperature can be engineered to be quite nice. It's 40 degrees or something like that. Above 40 degrees, semiconductors do not behave very well, and you start losing information. Definitely, if you put your hard drive in an oven, you lose memory. Much before it melts down. So you see, forbidding these processes is at the root of what we mean by information. Now look at here. This is classical information, right? I have zero or one. And this is an example of something that goes beyond classical information. We have the same probability of being in zero or in one, but these are two different coherent superpositions. It's the phase that counts. And quantum information requires that you have a memory register that preserves both these guys and these guys. So now you see that at the physical level, quantum information is fragile. If I build a hard drive the way we build classical hard drives, which are based on symmetry breaking, then the quantum information would be fragile. So why in places like this and IQC, we are all very hopeful to build a quantum computer, which is just a very interesting Schrödinger cat? Well, we can do two things. Either we can continuously, from outside, correct these errors. Professor Gottesman here is one of the invented a beautiful system, theory of quantum error correction codes called stabilizer codes that works. If we were able to build a machine which we can implement that code, that works, but it requires active intervention from outside. We basically need to pump entropy out of the system in order to preserve the information. But here, you see, in classical hard drives, you don't need to do that. They are robust at the physical level. So it would be very interesting. Can we have a quantum system that is robust at the physical level? And the answer that we understand from this simple example is, if we have symmetry breaking, then we are doomed. However, right now, symmetry breaking is the only system that we know to protect the classical part of the information. OK. Symmetry breaking is good for classical information and bad for quantum information. Okay. This is one of the many motivations of studying topological phases. They give us an opportunity to build big Schrödinger cats. All right. So we argued in perturbation theory that the critical point should be one between the paramagnetic and the ferromagnetic phase. Now I want to show this argument in a different way. And this is not only a very clever and elegant way to find the critical point of the Ising model, but it also shows you an example of a technique that is used a lot in high energy and string theory and quantum field theory, which is duality. So this is what we're gonna show now is the easiest example of duality that there is. Okay, so my Hamiltonian disappeared, so let me write it again. So as you can see, this is the Hamiltonian of a system of spins that are on a chain. And the spins reside on the sides of the chain. Now what I want to do is do a duality transformation. And by duality transformation, I mean some transformation such that I go from variables that are located on the sides to variables that are located on the bonds. So if you want these new variables in terms of the old labels are labeled by ii plus 1. Right? Because to identify this bond, I need to say what are the two sides. And so you already see that geometrically, what I get after I do this duality transformation, in which I replace the variables on the sides with the variables on the bonds, it's another chain. Okay? So the chain, by duality, goes into itself. So whatever I will find, it will be again a model on a chain. And now the next question is, a model of what? So what is, let's exhibit the duality transformation. Let me define two operators, tau 1, yes. Yes, you can either put periodic boundary conditions, or you can imagine an infinite chain. Let me define tau 1 at the site j here. Okay? So now I have new sites. As I said, in terms of the old variables, this j would be, for instance, in this case, I minus 2, I minus 1. OK, so this tau 1 at j is defined in terms of the old variables. That's why it's a transformation. And it is sigma z j, sigma z j plus 1. So basically, I called this site j. So in order to know what is my variable tau 1 here, I just multiply the two operators here and here, sigma z. OK? Well, I want to define also a second variable in terms of the sigma x operators on the old site. And it's the following one. So tau, let me call it tau 3 at j, yes, it will be the product over all the k's starting from some reference site up to j of sigma x k. So for instance, sigma tau 3j for this site is the product of sigma x on this site, on this site, on this site. It's a string of sigma x's starting from some reference point. Which is this reference point doesn't matter. You pick one. Okay? It's a long string. So this is our duality transformation. Notice that it's non-local in terms of the old variables, right? Because this can be an arbitrarily long string of x's. So again, pay attention to the difference between operators that are physical and operators that have only a mathematical meaning. I'm not saying that we could realize this transformation starting from a chain like this. This is a mathematical way of defining a transformation and see what happens. OK, so now it would be nice to see what this Hamiltonian becomes in terms of the tau variables. So this is, let me write this h sigma so that we remember these are the sigma variables. And under the duality transformation, it goes into a Hamiltonian that depends on the tau variables. So let's write it. This would be minus. Oh, but what is this? This is just tau 1, you see? It's just the sum over all the tau 1s. So this can be just the sum over these guys. And what about this term? This is slightly more complicated. What is sigma x at the site, say, I plus 1? Well, a way to realize that is to do the following thing. I take a string of x's that goes up to I plus 1. And then I take another string of x's that goes up to I, and I multiply them. If I do that, I get x squared, that is the identity, and I'm left with x here. So you see that sigma x at the given site is given by the product of tau 3 between two adjacent sites, because tau 3 is exactly this string. So this means that I can write this guy as the sum over all the tau 3j plus 1. I have relabeled the sides, so otherwise I should write minus 1 here and j here. It's the same thing, I just relabeled the sides. Very good. Well, and in fact, also I can do something silly, but it works. I take lambda out. So in front of here, I have 1 over lambda, and I multiply by lambda everything. Doesn't seem very, very interesting as something to do, but I can do that, right? I just brought lambda outside. Now notice something. What are these tau operators? Are the operators on what kind of space? So you have to understand that in linear algebra, you can infer on what space an operator acts just knowing the algebra of the operator. In fact, you have learned that the sigma poly matrices are just some representation of some algebra. What really matters is that they have the right commutation rules. For instance, we want tau 1, first of all, tau 1 square is equal to the identity, tau 3 square also being the identity. And we want tau 1 and tau 3 to anti-commute. If some variables obey this algebra, they are polymatrices. They act on a two-dimensional vector space. So if this were true, these are nothing but spin 1/2 variables. They're new spins. Are the spins obtained after the duality transformation. They're not the original spins here. But they're spins nonetheless. And this is in fact the case, and this is very, so these first two properties are very easy to show, because tau 1 and tau 3 are nothing but products of sigma operators, so they square to the identity. And these commutation rules also follow quite nicely, because what is tau 1? Okay, it's a string of x's. Sorry, tau 3 is a string of x's up to a certain site. And what is tau 1? Is two zetas in this way. And because of that, you see that all these parts commute with all this part that is the identity. This commutes with this, that is the identity, and they only overlap on one site. So on this site, they realize the same algebra than x and z, which is this. So this Hamiltonian is a spin 1/2 Hamiltonian. But now you see that it's not only a spin 1/2 Hamiltonian. It's a spin 1/2 Hamiltonian in which we have a nice encoupling plus a transverse field, because it's the one that does not commute with the other one, with a coupling 1 over lambda. So whatever is here in parentheses is H sigma, because now, you see, sigmas, it just means it spins 1/2, with a coupling 1 over lambda, and I have an overall lambda. So you see that under a duality transformation, the Ising model goes into itself, by just having an overall constant and inverting the Kappen constant. So this is called a self-duality. The transverse sizing model is self-dual. What does it mean? It means that all the properties of H of lambda can be mapped into the properties of H of 1 over lambda. Yes?
Why do you not also need the regular commutation?
So this is enough to establish the polyalgebra. So you can show that if operators are like this, everything else follows. So this is the minimal set. The regular commutation also holds, but it is a consequence.
But can't you represent this in dimension higher than 2?
Okay. Asking me whether the 2D Ising model is self-dual in 2 special dimensions.
Well, no, I'm saying like you have these relations, but that doesn't tell you the dimension of the space they act on, right?
No, it does. If you have this, the vector space in which they act is 2-dimensional. Okay, so let's exploit a consequence of this fact. Okay, so a consequence of this fact is the following. So first of all, if I have an eigenvalue for some of this Hamiltonian for a certain value of lambda, this must be equal to the eigenvalue of this Hamiltonian for 1 over lambda. But it's the same Hamiltonian. So it must be equal to lambda E 1 over lambda. So we have these very interesting relations between the Hamiltonians, between the eigenvalues of this model. And now imagine that I take a pair of these eigenvalues, namely the ground state and the first excited state, and I subtract one to the other. Then we would have that the gap, dE of lambda, must be equal to lambda, the gap, at 1 over lambda. Okay. Well, this doesn't say much, okay? But now let's, it does say a lot, but it's not enough yet. So now imagine that we specialize to the value of lambda such that this is 0. Okay? So we are looking for the value of lambda such that the gap is 0, the critical point. And we just make the assumption, it could be wrong, so here there is a little bit of art, but we make the assumption that this critical point is unique. In other words, that between the paramagnetic phase and the ferromagnetic phase, there is no other phase in between. We just say it's unique. So there is only one lambda such that this is 0. So you see that the only solution is lambda equal 1 over lambda, which means lambda equal 1. So you see that without solving the model, without doing any calculation, by realizing that it's self-dual, we find the critical point. So this is a very powerful method, and that is used a lot in more sophisticated ways in theoretical physics. Okay. So we have seen 2 arguments so far to say where is the critical point of the quantum Ising model. The first one is perturbation theory. The second one is duality. And then there is brute force. Brute force is diagonalizing
the model.
And it's such an amazing thing that we are able to exactly solve this model. It's by no chance a trivial task. We can. And this is very interesting for three reasons. First of all, it's always nice to have exact results. We can compute exactly all the values of any observable for every value of the parameters. Second, the technique that we use is very important in theoretical physics. We use it in a fairly large class of models. In some sense, all the models in quantum mechanics that can be solved belong to either this category or another category of ways of solving that is called Bethe ansatz. The third reason is that there is something very peculiar in quantum mechanics for these models that are integrable. Integrable means we can what it means is a very complicated issue, but naively speaking means, oh, we can exhibit an exact solution. And we will talk more about this, about the interplay between integrability and physics when we will talk about how quantum mechanical systems reach equilibrium. So this one is an integrable mode. Okay, so how do we solve it? Okay, so there is a fairly long procedure that I will sketch now and whose details will be the material for the tutorial of tomorrow. And I will show the logical steps of this diagonalization. Then there is a bit of algebra to do that one should do a few times in their lives before feeling you are a theoretical physicist. Okay, so let me in fact write the Hamiltonian of another quantum model that is related, it's a relative of the quantumizing model. It's the following. So we have an index that goes from minus m to m. It's again a spin chain. So it's a spin chain with n equal 2m plus 1 spins. So odd number of spins. And then we have couplings of the Ising type. But we have them in two directions. So not only in the x direction, or I used z there, but doesn't matter. Not only in one direction, but also in another direction, we have a nice coupling. And then we have our transverse field. So if I did nothing more, this would be really no different from the Ising model. However, I can decide that these two terms have different weights. And these different weights, we call them gamma. So we put 1 plus gamma over 2 here, and 1 minus gamma over 2 here. So gamma is called the anisotropy of the quantum XY model. Why do I show this model instead of the quantumizing model? This is a generalization because you see that for gamma equal 1, it is an instance of this model. Actually, this is an instance of that model for a gamma equal 1. But it's a bit richer. It has two parameters, right? It's not just lambda. We have gamma and lambda. So our phase space is two-dimensional. And the technique for diagonalizing it is exactly the same than for the quantumizing model. So the first thing that you do is to define the plus and minus operators, that, as you know, these are just 1/2 sigma x plus minus I sigma y. Okay, so we know what is a plus. And then we define, again, a long string operator, a bit like here. So we want to, in order to diagonalize this model, we want to go to new variables. And again, we do some non-local transformation. It's just a way to solve the model. So the transformation that we do is the following. We act with the sigma plus at the site L. But before that, on all the other sites before L, we act with some string operator that is the product of sigma z on all the sites between the first site, whichever is the one that you label by 1, and L minus 1. So we have this long string operator, and we call it C plus. Actually, let me call it C. Yes. C plus, yes. Now, you could also define C minus in a very similar way by just put minus here. If you do that, you will discover that the operators C plus and C minus are so let me call it just C without the minus. Behave like Fermion operators. So these new degrees of freedom are fermionic. So it's very interesting that from a model that is completely bosonic, because spin operators are bosonic, right? They commute a distance. We can get fermions. It's a bit weird. Also, our understanding of statistics in quantum theory seems weird. How is it possible that from bosons you get fermions, right? Because bosons, we know you can pile up as many bosons as you want. Fermions, you can't. Well, this comes from the fact that sigma plus the square, if you do the calculation, is 0. So these are so-called hardcore bosons. They are bosons, but you cannot put more than 1 on the same site. So they have something. They have like an exclusion principle because they have this problem. But doesn't come from statistics. So in terms of these variables, you do this substitution, and you would find an Hamiltonian. So this you will see tomorrow in the tutorial that is quadratic. This is not enough yet. We need to do a second transformation that is a Fourier transform. So what we do is to define these operators in the k-space, in the momentum space. Here we have some normalization that is the number of spins. Then we take our Cn operators, and we sum over all of them with some wave number, Kn. And of course, you need to see the details of how this Kn depends on this label L. But completeness should suggest you that you have as many labels Kn as labels N. OK, so once you insert this transformation, and then this transformation inside this Hamiltonian, you land into something that looks like this. You have 2, the sum over k, then you have some eigenvalue epsilon k, sorry, some function of k, and then you have c dagger c k k plus c dagger minus k c minus k. So this is a term that creates a fermion k of wave number k and this of wave number minus k. And then you have a Hopping term with another constant delta k, which is psi dagger k minus k plus psi k minus k. So this creates and destroys fermions. This is just the number operator. Okay, so you can see that this Hamiltonian is quadratic, so it can be diagonalized. Because it's a quadratic operator as a matrix. The only thing that we are left to do is to find, you know, what is the right set of eigenvectors. And we would like to start with the ground state. But you see that the ground state is not the vacuum of these operators, because there is also this term that does not commute. But in the space k minus k, this is a 2x2 matrix. It's easy to diagonalize. And this diagonalization with the coefficients for this diagonalization is called the Bogoliubov transformation. It's a transformation on a space that is 2x2. So in the end, after the Bogoliubov transformation, in which you do a rotation in this space, and you define new operators eta k, this Hamiltonian becomes the sum over k of things like this. And you have, lambda k here. Plus a constant that is the ground state energy. This lambda k is the energy of the excitations above the ground state. And, for instance, for the Ising model, goes like 1 minus 2 lambda cosine k plus lambda square. So you see that, for instance, for for k equal pi, I'm thinking whether I made a sign error somewhere. Let me click the notes. Ah, yeah, there is a plus. Okay. So for k equal pi, this becomes, for k equal pi, this becomes 1 minus lambda, absolute value. So you see, these excitations, these energies above the ground state, the gap, go to 0 for lambda equal 1, an exact solution. Here there is a very important subtlety that you will see in the tutorial, and it is that in order for k being equal to pi, when you define this k in terms of the labels of the spins, well, you need to see whether this equation has a solution. Can k be equal to, can k have the value pi? And the answer is not. So it seems all wrong. However, you will see that when you send n to infinity, then that equation has a solution. Basically, k becomes a continuous index because k is something like 2 pi n over large n plus 1, something like that. So this is not a continuous index, so cannot always solve every equation, but when n becomes large, then you have the solution k equal pi. And therefore, only then you have gapless excitations. So, which is a manifestation of the fact that the quantum critical point only exists in the thermodynamic limit. When n is finite, all excitations are finite. Okay, so these are the logical steps of the diagonalization of the XY model. And in the tutorial, you will just very carefully insert all these terms in the Hamiltonian and see how it becomes this one, this quadratic form. Okay, sorry, I went over time.